produced by Jeffrey Chrysalias, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 433. What did they do next? Part 14A, Trevor Rabin.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 433 of the Yes Music Podcast, Two Fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. With the news that Trevor Rabin is working on a new solo record, Mark and I bend the rules of the What Did They Do Next series almost to breaking point, so we can take a look at Trevor's 1989 album, Can't Look Away. Messages of protestation welcome, but not necessary. This week we discuss our expectations of the record, and then next week we'll feedback on our listening experiences. I didn't have any time for updates last week, so here are some from the previous 2 weeks. Yes announced a slew of rearranged UK dates for the album Series 2021 tour. Here's how they put it. Yes announced rescheduled UK dates due to the coronavirus pandemic for the album Series 2021 tour. The tour was originally scheduled to kick off this month in Liverpool. It will now begin on 16th of May 2021 in Manchester. The show will feature their 1974 Relayer album in its entirety, together with a selection of other classic Yes favourites. Alan White said, "Many things have changed in the world these past few months. My appreciation for the freedoms we've enjoyed in the past has grown, along with my gratitude for all the people caring for humanity throughout the world. I can't wait to be on stage again in front of real audiences playing Yes music. I'm hoping we can bring some joy and positivity back into our lives. Please take care and stay safe. We want to see our many fans and friends again in 2021. Sincerely, Alan White." For full details and to book tickets for all shows, you can go to bookingsdirect.com or yesworld.com for all the dates. Also around the social webs, starting on the YMP Facebook page, Daniel Crone posted a video of him playing and singing his own composition, When the World Turns On, as well as his reactions to the Yes 50 live package. Paul Watson passed on the good news that John Kirkman, author of many books about Yes, has been updating his YouTube channel with lots of his interviews. And it was Bill Bruford's birthday. Many happy returns. I shared the rather marvellous video about the YMP trivia card game and the associated A3 art print of what we've called the Full Union. Both products are available on yesmusicpodcast.com/shop, but do be quick, as there are only going to be 100 card games and 50 prints up for grabs. As I said a couple of weeks ago, as a listener to the podcast, you can use the exclusive money-off coupon code YMPLISTENER, all capitals and all one word. News of Trevor Rabin's solo album was posted by Daniel, and he also added his extensive thoughts on what he'd like to see from a new Yes studio record. I was asked by Preston Frazier to review The Fly From Here Suite from the 2011 album for his Something Else Reviews series. And as for the deluge of brilliant visitor posts, I'm going to have to leave you to take a look yourself, other than to mention just a few. Brian Sullivan added Squire and Howe's 1976 cover of Bob Dylan's Positively 4th Street. And Tony Handley posted the remarks I read out earlier from Alan White about the rescheduled tour dates. Jeffrey Mason added news of Rick Wakeman's next Christmas show and also asked for help about the following. He says, "Yes Music Podcast team, alumni, listeners, fans and people who just happen to read this, I need your help. I have some questions about Starship Trooper on Yes songs, both the album and the concert movie. First, I know the lyrics for Starship Trooper was recorded on Yes album, but does anyone have the lyrics that John actually sang during the Yes songs concert recording? It was supposedly recorded live on the 15th of December 1972 at the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park, London. It is definitely Rick Wakeman on keys and certainly sounds like Alan White and not Bill Bruford on drums for both the album and movie. Wakeman and White were definitely performing in the Rainbow Theatre sections of the Yes songs movie. In the Yes songs movie, we only get to see the end Verm section of Starship Trooper during the end credits. The movie screen credits, of course, omit Bill Bruford entirely because he didn't perform at the Rainbow Theatre for that concert. Is the Starship Trooper recorded on the album the same as in the movie? Does any more complete video of that live version, the 15th of December 1972 Starship Trooper, exist? Does anyone know of any earlier instances of Starship Trooper being played live? I'm already aware of For Everyone, early version of the Disillusion section, being played live in 1970. So, can you help? If so, let us know. It was Rick Wakeman's birthday as well, as pointed out by Doug Curran, and it was Jay Shallon's birthday, also spotted by Doug. Happy 50th to Mike O'Connor, who shared a great Chris Squire bass line recorded for him as a present by his childhood buddy Rich Hoffman. And it's very good. And finally for this section, Brian Sullivan shared a mashed-up song called Birdland Runaround by Standard Deviations, which is well worth listening to. As always, many thanks to everyone who got in touch in the last couple of weeks in any way, including the commenters on last week's show notes, John D., Dave Watkinson, Paul Tomei, and Anthony Green. Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Pretty good. Enjoying a very lovely sunny day here. I'm very pleased about that.
Well, over the other side of the Atlantic, it's just the same, actually. It's very sunny and very warm, so marvellous. Okay, So ideal for talking about Trevor Rabin. Now, this was a pretty difficult period of Yes history. So as we saw last time we did one of these, John Anderson left and did his City of Angels after the Big Generator tour, and then he went on to recreate Yes in his own image, as it were, as ABWH. And so Yes West, as they were called at the time, with Rabin, White, Squire and Kay, basically the cinema lineup again. Remember that episode that we did with Dave Watkinson and John D about that cinema rehearsal? Marvellous episode that was. But they were found themselves back in that configuration. And at various different times, there were rumours of Tony Kaye leaving again and all sorts of legal shenanigans, not for the last time, over the use of the Yes name. And eventually they got permission from the lawyers to call it an evening of Yes Music Plus. And I've got that recording just up here next to me as we start off today. So Yes West were doing some work on material, I understand, but they didn't have a lead singer. And during this time, they were looking around for various people, including Billy Sherwood, I think, may have been asked to do to do some vocals, but he didn't want to do that. So what are your recollections, Mark, of this time? Did you know that Yes were sitting there as Yes West and ABWH were coming round the bend?
No, back during those times, I didn't know very much about it. I mean, you know, now we're blessed with the internet and we can get stuff at a, you know, rapid pace. But back then, I didn't really know much, except that I just kind of figured that, you know, Yes, we're working on things in the background and, you know, maybe to expect something a little bit later down the road to come out. But no, I didn't know much about what was going on at that time. So it's kind of interesting now, years later, when we started hearing about all these things, to hear about this. I mean, I remember Billy Sherwood, actually, I think it might have even been on either his Facebook or somewhere, he posted a photo of him back in those days when they were saying that he was being, you know, swooed by, I think it was maybe even Atlantic at that time, Records, to kind of convince him to, you know, put aside his other band and to come on and do some lead vocal stuff for Yes. While he loved Yes, he just felt that at that time it wasn't the right move for him to do. So he actually turned it down.
Absolutely. And Roger Hodgson did work with them a little bit, I understand, but that didn't work out either. And we have some co-written Roger Hodgson Yes music, of course. But at this time, Trevor Rabin, it seems that he got a little bit of itchy feet and wanted to be doing some something. So here's how Dave Watkinson describes this time in his book Perpetual Change. So at the time of the ABWH tour over in California, Yes hadn't finalised the material for their next album, and so Trevor Rabin took the opportunity to work on his next solo album. Following the release of the album Can't Look Away, he undertook his first solo tour of small venues in the USA and Canada throughout November and December 1989. By the end of the year, the official Yes did not have any material ready for release and were not ready to perform live, in contrast to ABWH, who had sold 750,000 copies of their album to great public and critical acclaim. So it's we are stretching the concept of what did they do next even further than we have done previously, because Trevor Rabin... This album was suggested to me by Daniel Crone, who suggested that Trevor Rabin had left Yes for the time as he went and did this album. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not sure it really matters in the end. It's really interesting to be able to look at Can't Look Away and what Trevor Rabin thought of as his own music. And just before we get on to discussing that a little bit more, here's Tim Morse, Yes, in their own words, Yes Stories book, has gotten very interesting quotation from Trevor himself about ABWH and all that time. He said, "The ABWH album came out at the same time as my solo album, and a guy from Arista said we were really kind of worried because Something to Hold On To from Trevor's album was number one on album-oriented radio, and ABWH was number three. It was like a big battle between the two. And I didn't know that. I don't think of music as a battle," says Rabin. "I bought the ABWH album and just enjoyed it. I didn't listen to it under any other terms." So, there we are then. So, depending on who you talk to, Trevor Rabin in direct competition with ABWH, and a lot of people, probably including me, regard ABWH as pretty much a Yes album. So maybe we could say, for the purposes of this discussion, that Trevor Rabin was out of Yes and ABWH were Yes. I should get into a huge amount of trouble for that. But anyway, that's the basis on which we're going to have a look at this album. And it's an album you know very well, isn't it, Mark?
Yes. Actually, it's probably one of my favorite Trevor Rabin records. Probably is my favorite one. I do like Wolf and some of the other ones that he's released as well. He's done some pretty interesting solo records, but this is definitely one that kind of stands up head and shoulders above the other ones, mainly because I think his songwriting was very solidified by this point. He's had four solo records at this point. This one being his fourth. I think by this point he had kind of really ironed out his sort of writing style, you know, having done 90125 and Big Generator before that. I find it interesting, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, but I do hear quite a little bit of that writing style seep in to this album. I mean, I haven't listened to it yet. That's one thing I made sure I didn't do, because I wanted to approach it fresh next week together. But from what I do remember, like especially the single, because I mean, that's a pretty memorable song, Something to Hold On To. There are guitar parts in there that are very reminiscent to Love Will Find a Way in there. To me, like, I instantly kind of picked that out when I remember hearing that song. But you know, that's just his style of writing. Maybe at that time he was into that kind of chord voicings and arpeggiated sort of chords, but I think that that's one thing that made this record very strong. And the other thing I think was the involvement of Bob Ezrin, who was a very, you know, in-demand producer at that time, and he definitely added his sort of signature production style, those kind of big drums and big reverbs and stuff like that to his record. And it is very 80-ish sounding because of that, but it's very, very well produced and very, very strong record, obviously.
Okay, well, yes, I have the CD of it, but I have to say that I haven't played it for some time, and I've only played it a couple of times in total, I think, since I bought it, for whatever reason, and perhaps we'll find out next week why that is. And I was looking at the track listing, so Can't Look Away, which is the title track, Something to Hold On To, which is the single, as you were just saying, and then there are some interesting ones further down. Étoile Noire, which is French. Noir is obviously black. Étoile, I've forgotten what that means, so I'll have to look that up. But particularly Sludge, what an interesting title. So we'll see what that actually is. And in the CD version, the front cover has got that moody photograph of Trevor, which I'm sure everyone very much likes in his black leather jacket, and it's it looks as if it's been shot with some kind of a bullet has smashed the CD case. But you've got vinyl records. Anything interesting about the vinyl record version of it at all?
The there's nothing maybe particularly interesting about the sort of standard one that came out, but the copy that I own is pretty interesting because I have a white label promo version of this album.
Right.
And if you take a look at the cover, I did include some photos I sent to you.
Indeed.
That will be on this week's notes. But this one I found extremely interesting because they really went to town with the sort of hype stickers, as they call them, on the front. Right. They have here, you know, the debut Elektra release featuring the single Something to Hold On To. So obviously he was on a different record label, you know, although Atlantic, I think Atlantic was at maybe that point starting the whole WEA thing where it was Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic together.
Yeah.
So maybe they were still kind of under the same umbrella. And there's also, there's a little small indicator on the sticker that kind of shows you that it's a Direct Metal Mastering, DMM, on here. Has a nice sticker on here saying that it's pressed on high-quality audiophile vinyl, which is true, because when you take it out and hold it up to the light, it's a translucent root beer brown vinyl.
Oh.
Right?
Right.
And on here, there's another sticker, which I'm not sure what this is supposed to be. It just says, when you play it, say it. I don't know if there's some kind of like hype thing for some kind of, you know, I don't know, some kind of campaign that they were doing at that time. But it's very interesting. They really went to town with this pressing of it because it sounds fantastic from what I remember. Of course, I'm going to be listening to it next week and I'll give you more of an update then.
Yeah.
But it's really well done from what I remember. And obviously, being that it was a promo copy, they wanted to give you the best quality sounding record that you can. And we know with the way that Trevor writes his songs, very well produced, and with Bob Ezrin on there, this is just like a match made in heaven from what I remember.
Yes, indeed. And speaking of matches made in heaven, Trevor plays all the instruments apart from one, which is the drum kit. And our friend Lou Molina III is on drums. So the right back in the 80s there. I mean, do you know of Lou collaborating with Trevor before this? Was he on the other solo albums?
I don't recall offhand. I mean, that's something that I'm going to have to do some research into for next week when we discuss this, because I am very interested about that as well. But another thing that was interesting that I kind of noticed as well about this record was the appearance of our good friend Alan White on a couple of songs on drums.
Oh, right. I hadn't realized that.
On this, yeah, he's on there as well. And somebody by the name of Basil. That's all it says. Drums by Basil. Now, I don't know if Basil is supposed to be a Lynn drum machine, maybe, that you know Bob Ezrin has decided to bring in for a couple of songs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they just named it Basil, similarly to how Genesis named their drum machine. I don't remember the name they gave it, but it was something ridiculous like Arthur or something like that. So maybe Basil is their name for their drum machine.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's fascinating. I hadn't picked up the fact that Alan White was on it, so that'll be very interesting to hear. He's one of those drummers, probably like Lee Molino and others as well, of course, but certainly you always know when it's Alan on the drums. And I remember very distinctly the first time I saw Alan when he was taking over from Jay live in a Yes concert. And as soon as Alan sat down, same kit, same everything, same amplification, and just sounded completely different. I don't know what it is. It's something to do with the touch and the feel and so on. Not that I'm saying that Jay isn't a fantastic drummer. He is as well, but something very special about Alan White's drumming. However, I was going to ask you a little bit about solo albums themselves, and we've talked about this before in relation to other Yes members' solo albums, but I get the feeling that sometimes, and my example that I always give of this is Brian May, that sometimes in a solo album, people who get their own way, like Dr. May, tend to ruin the balance. So in Brian May solo albums, and I've heard a couple, I think there's just too much of his guitar. The songs are so based on the guitar, so focused on the guitar, that it makes it less interesting than if it was a band record. Is that something that you've found with other solo albums as well?
I think that that is the case in certain situations, and I'll explain. Because like you said, Brian May's album is a fantastic example of, you know, over-the-top guitars. Mm. Because, you know, he's a guitarist, obviously, and that's his thing. And even in Queen, you know, he does orchestrations, you know, yeah, mimics other instruments with his guitar, so on and so forth. But in this situation, I don't think it's necessarily the case. And I think the reason why is because he had to do several other things as well. You know, he couldn't go, he didn't really think so guitar because, you know, he had to think about doing bass. He had to think about doing keyboards. Mm. He had to think about singing, and singing is a big part of this album. And right. So, you know, rather than sitting there thinking about, you know, what kind of, you know, 17th guitar track can I add to this song? He probably thought about what kind of maybe vocal harmonies he could add to it instead. So I think that kind of balanced out his sort of, you know, approach to writing the record. I mean, I'm kind of looking at it the same way with myself. I think if I had people involved in my records, like, for example, I have a record coming out in June with the Dark Monarchy, that other band that I have, in which Joe did some of the bass guitar, some of the drumming, and some of the keyboard stuff, which left me to do, you know, more guitar stuff. And because of that, I ended up finding that I had did a lot more guitar stuff than I would have done maybe on Project Gemini stuff. So I think that adding in another person sometimes takes away, you know, that that sort of, you know, thing to it. Because I mean, if you're doing, if when you don't have to do everything, then you can focus more on one thing, and then it's then you can go overboard with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another interesting one, isn't it, is Steve Howe. Now, Steve Howe's solo albums, obviously there were a lot of musicians and, you know, from Patrick Mraz to Alan White to Bill Bruford to all sorts of other people on his solo albums. But if we get to speak to Steve, and I hope we do, about his latest solo album, I really want to know from him what makes a Steve Howe solo album different to a Steve Howe trio album or whatever. Does he approach it differently? And I think it's a fascinating thing. Now, of course, with other Yes men, including Steve Howe himself, they are able to lead the way, but in different ways. So Elias, of course, famously put together by John Anderson completely himself, as you were saying previously. But and that was brilliant. And Fish Out of Water, though, was more collaborative. You've got more people in there. You've got the orchestrator. You've got the drummers and the other musicians taking part in that. So it is possible to create a very much a solo. Because there's no way that you could say that Fish Out of Water is moving towards a sort of band. No, it's definitely Chris Squire. His stamp is all over it. So it is possible to work with other musicians and yet still have a solo album, but sometimes that doesn't work, as you've just explained very, very well, I think, with the Brian May example. So what about the more recent Rabin solo material? Now, I'm thinking of the Jacaranda, I think that was what it was called, which I listened to. And it seemed to be really quite varied and had quite a lot of subtlety in it. At this time and those earlier Rabin albums that I haven't heard, is he more of a similar style throughout the album, or does it have some changes and some contrasts?
Well, Jacaranda I liked. It very much... he explored some other elements of music. Like he had some kind of jazzier parts, more clean tone stuff, you know, the semi hollow body guitar kind of sounds and stuff like that. So that was kind of nice. I mean, that was a way to explore and get deep into a guitar without it being too over the top, I think, because sometimes just changing a guitar and getting a different sound is enough to appease a guitar player's soul. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He doesn't need to do 20 tracks of guitars if he just has one that he really likes the sound of.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in prior records, though, I still think that he had sort of a similar approach, because he was very much a let me do as much as I can sort of person back then.
Yeah.
So and I think especially once you're a guitar player that has to do vocals as well, I think that's where the balance comes in, because you have to realize that if I make these guitar parts too crazy, I still have to sing this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think that's what kind of levels it out. That's one thing that, for example, Brian May maybe didn't have to worry about on his solo record. You know, he doesn't have to go out and maybe sing all this stuff. So he can go do like, you know, seven guitars, you know, in unison or in harmony doing this section and 20 guitars doing this all at once, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, we must point out that we're not having a dig at Brian May. We love Brian May.
No, not at all.
And everything that he's done. But I do find his solo albums a little difficult to get through. It's one of those situations for me, again, which I can take individual tracks from those Brian May albums and really enjoy them. But a whole, sitting down and listening to a whole Brian May solo album is a bit much for me, for the reasons that we've just gone into. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm very much looking forward to listening to this album, Trevor Rabin's solo album. I can't look away. And I look forward to speaking to you about it next week, Mark.
Oh, and by the way, that Etoile is a star.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, yes. Black Star. So, oh, and it's only 1 minute and 3 seconds long, that song. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what that's about. Wonderful. All right. Well, I'll speak to you next week, Mark.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulrine and Mark Anthony Kay.
Just before we go, here are the producers and the patrons, or at least half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And half of those patrons are Erin Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, Dave Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, David Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian M.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Michael Handahan, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in keeping the lights on here at YMP Towers, then head over to yesmusicpodcast.com and click on the patron button. Or alternatively, go to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thank you so much for listening once again. Next week, I do hope we'll be back talking about our reflections on the actual music on that Trevor Rabin solo album. But in the meantime, please do keep getting involved with the podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, or on Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.